Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's event. We, this evening, are going to be discussing a topic which I suppose is not only topical, but ongoing in a variety of different ways. The title of this evening's seminar is Fiscal Space in the Eurozone, Redistribution in Greece and Ireland. And we have two speakers this evening who I'm very, very happy to welcome and to introduce to you, because they are very close collaborators of the Hellenic Observatory, and they play an important role in what we do, each in their own way. I will do this alphabetically so as not to offend anybody. Our first speaker, or one of the speakers this evening, is Angelos Angelou, who is a PhD candidate in the European Institute. In fact, you are defending your PhD in a month's time, I think, Angelos.
Yes.
So we wish you the best of luck in that.
Highly appreciate it.
Angelos generally works on international bureaucracies and how they address new policy questions during times of crisis. Angelos has got an MA in European Studies and International Economics from SAIS Johns Hopkins, and he's also worked at the Wilfred Martin Center for European Studies before coming to the LSE, correct?
And the Commission.
You can talk about that later. The other half of this tandem this evening is Dr. Christoula Papalexadou. She recently defended her PhD, and we'd like to congratulate her on that. And she is now currently in the observatory as our Hellenic Bank Association postdoctoral fellow, and she will be here with us for the rest of the year. Before joining the European Institute, where she did her PhD, Christoula studied economics and politics and economics of Southeastern Europe at the University of Macedonia. She has had practical and professional experience at the National Bank of Greece, and she generally focuses on the political economy of monetary integration and economic inequality. I'm not sure how you're going to do this exactly, who's going to speak first, but you're going to speak for roughly 30 minutes or so.
Yes.
So the floor is yours.
Excellent. Okay. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to our presentation. So the outline of the presentation will be as follows. We'll start by explaining to you the empirical puzzle that motivated me and Angelos to embark on that project and to write this paper. Then I will locate our paper in the literature and explain the whole debate around our question. And then Angelos will go in more depth in our country cases that I guess some of you are interested in, Greece and Ireland, and then hopefully we'll discuss the results with you. So let me start. As Spiros has already mentioned, thank you Spiros for you're welcoming. Our paper is called Euro Area and Fiscal Space, Redistribution in Greece and Ireland. So the whole idea of this project started from an empirical puzzle that we observed with Angelos. So the idea was that we started seeing the initial member states of the Eurozone, and we've seen that between the period of the Maastricht and prior to the financial crisis, actually the change in total social expenditure was not negative everywhere, but on the contrary, we had an increase in the so-called peripheral states. This is a controversial term, but I will mainly refer to these economies as the peripheral economies, but keeping in mind that I mean the ex-high inflation economies that had to adjust the most in order to get into the euro area. And then we looked a bit at the data of disposable income inequality, which is after government intervention, so after taxes and transfers, and we've seen that inequality did not increase everywhere. Again, on the contrary, we've seen in these so-called peripheral states that we see, not all of them, but some of them, that there was a decrease. So why is this puzzling, you'll ask me? So why did we find this finding quite interesting to explore further? So this has to do with the fact that the predominant wisdom on the literature was quite different. So prior to the adoption of the common currency, the idea was that the euro adoption would actually lead to hard budget constraints. So what does this mean? It would mean that due to the Maastricht criteria and due to the Stability and Growth Pact, governments wouldn't have so much room for maneuver. What would this imply? It would imply that the euro area would potentially act as a vehicle external. We would see some we would expect to see some structural reforms. And what would this mean for social spending? I mean, it was not really conclusive, but most of the literature was suggesting at the time that we would expect due to cost containment, because they had to manage to comply with the Maastricht criteria, and they were under a rigid macroeconomic framework of the ECB, that these economies would actually increase their social spending. So this was the fear, as I call it, before the adoption of the common currency. Would this mean that necessarily inequality would go up? Well, again, as I say, we cannot be sure, but because as we know, of course, it depends a lot on how much you spend on your wealth, but also the progressivity and the design of the welfare system matters. But in general, there was this fear that we would see a decrease in welfare state spending. Well, these are the old days, right? We forget about this idea. The euro came and things did not happen as we would expect them to happen. What do I mean by that? It is very clear for all of us now that euro area did not mean hard budget constraints. On the contrary, the new, and I'm referring again just to make that clear, prior to the financial crisis, because then the picture changes, we can discuss that in the Q&A. So the idea was that especially for these peripheral states, actually the euro area met soft budget constraints. Why? The idea was that the SCP was never implemented as it would have been expected, and at the same time, these economies had a massive decrease on their interest rates, which reduced massively also the cost of their public debt. Also, as we know from these economies, most of them experienced a very high growth performance. That would mean that they were having increasing tax revenues during that time. So then a new literature emerges, again quite worrisome, that actually says, look, there is another problem here. Exactly because there are soft budget constraints and not hard budget constraints, we will have no reforms. And not only that, we will actually have institutional deterioration. This is the seminal work of Villaverde and Fernandez that we will refer quite a lot to that. What was the idea behind that? So these scholars were mainly making the arguments based on emerging economies. And they were saying that we have observed from emerging economies that when they were receiving financial aid from abroad or when they were increasing their foreign debt, what was happening is that the governments would say, we'll postpone the reforms for later on. We have the ability to do that. Let's leave that for the next government. And also they say that when an economy is going so well, and it's booming, it is highly likely that you won't see the problematic parts of it. So if the tide is rising, then you are not able to understand exactly where and locate the problem, as it happens, for instance, in the cases of the housing bubbles in Ireland and Spain. So this literature remains agnostic towards inequality. They don't go one step further. They mainly stay on that, and they say, look, pretty much we expect no reform effort, and we do not know exactly what would happen in social spending. And this is where me and Angelos come in, and we are saying that, well, undeniable, with the benefit of hindsight, we know that the euro area did not mean for this economy's hard budget constraints. It meant soft budget constraints or fiscal space. Why do I refer to this term? This is the term that the ECB and the IMF love after the crisis. So to explain it very briefly, fiscal space is the rule that the government has to increase spending or reduce taxes without endangering its market access or its debt sustainability. And there are a lot of definitions of it, but I'm trying to explain it as easy as possible. And we are actually suggesting, in contrast to Villaverde and Fernandez, that it didn't lead to reform postponement. On the contrary, it allowed for some parametric reforms that did not necessarily lead to institutional deterioration. And we suggest that this is what explains the increase in social spending and inequality. Let me try to explain the argument step by step before actually Angelos goes into the case studies, so that we'll make sure that you understand our line of thinking. So as we said, for ex-high inflation economies, the euro area comes with the creation of fiscal space. So the cost of public debt is reduced massively, and they have increasing tax revenues. Also, the maturity of the debt changes. So it's mainly long-term instead of short-term. However, that on its own, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. So what the fiscal space, what the governments will do with this fiscal space created, still remains in national hands. We cannot know from the beginning. We suggest that some of this fiscal space was used for social spending. However, again, does this mean that it would be used in an equalizing way? No. And this is the second question that we are asking. We suggest, we are asking whether this use of fiscal space was tied to a particular reform narrative. So was it tied to an institutional deterioration or status quo preservation or modernization? Here I have to do one step back to explain what do we mean with that. So usually, especially in southern economies, we have quite clientelistic welfare states. So if a government increases welfare spending, but it mainly gives the social spending to the insiders of the welfare system, probably this wouldn't mean that we would have an improvement in terms of social outcomes and equality. On the contrary, if they decide to use this newly created fiscal space in order to implement reforms that would be more inclusive, then this would mean that we would probably see a more equitable distribution of transfers. Again, we have to stop here for a moment and discuss the following. The idea of modernization, and I mean, we have Kevin in the audience, and we can, I mean, that he has written on these things extensively, but what Fernandez and Villaverde mainly do is that they assess the reform effort in terms of fiscal sustainability. So the idea of modernization, especially in the 90s, was always assessed of whether actually the system is going to be fiscally sustainable in terms of efficiency. If you go back in the literature in the 1980s, though, and you start reading from the Commission, the idea of modernization was different. Modernization back in the 1980s meant democratization around values like equality and social justice. So the difference with me and with what me and Angelos are trying to do is that we are also want to take this into account. So we feel that the debate was very much dominant of whether the reforms were towards the direction of fiscal discipline, but that it is not discussed so much whether actually equality was taken into account in all these first years that, you know, there are all these narratives that nothing could happen in the periphery. So on that, with this in the back of your head, now we are going to go in the country cases, Greece and Ireland, two very diverse cases, and we're going to discuss a very particular area of transfers, pensions, which are very highly politicized, and to see whether actually we can find even this area of transfers some reform effort along these lines. Angela?
So the way we approach it in terms of case study selection is that we actually pick Greece and Ireland as two most different cases. For the ones that are actually not adept with the methodology jargon, two most different cases actually mean that they have the same outcome, but they actually start from very different premises, which is kind of puzzling. So why the two countries are actually so different, and why they are actually interesting to study? So first of all, for the variety of capitalism literature, so the one that actually talks about complementarity between firms and the government, they actually are parts of very different families. Greece is part of the mixed market economy models, while Ireland is closer to the liberal paradigm, right? So the second part that actually is very different has to do with the fact that the two countries actually are part of different social welfare models, according to the Espen Andersen typology. So Greece, on the one hand, is more of a southern model type of welfare state, which means actually a fragmented income maintenance systems with highly dualism between insiders and outsiders of the system. So, you know, usually the insider could actually have more lobby power, would be more able to kind of influence the government policy on pensions, but welfare in general. While outsiders, i.e., for example, the Greek case, women, young employees or immigrants, would not actually have that lobby power. Greece is kind of a typical case of this kind of welfare model. On the other hand, Ireland is closer to the liberal paradigm in terms of welfare state, and that means actually that you have small provisions, which are actually usually mean-tested, so they are very much actually focused and benefiting the lower quantiles of the income distribution. That's the second aspect where they actually very, very different. Another crucial difference between the two is that they actually are very much different on how they perform within the Eurozone in terms of economic growth. So, for example, in terms of how much they abide with the institutional rules of the Eurozone. So, for example, we know that Ireland has been the poster child of the SGP, usually being in abidance with the conditions and the rules of the SGP, while Greece has been one of the constant laggards, right? So, very different in terms of how they perform within the Eurozone. Another thing is that even before they entered the Eurozone, they had actually very different growth trajectories. So, for example, Ireland had actually some decades of robust growth before going into the Eurozone, while Greece actually only picked up in terms of growth trajectory only after entering the Eurozone. Another important difference, and this is where actually we might be able to talk more about this in the Q&A, is that they actually had governments of governments on different orientation. So the Irish government at the time of the reform was more like close to the liberal centre-right paradigm, while the Greece actually had the moderate social democratic government. So very different types of ideology and political orientation at the time. So what we actually saw here is that actually the two countries actually start from a very different premise, and yet they actually implement the same reform as we're going to actually discuss later on. But why do we take the pension reform, right? Why do we actually pick this particular policy area? The reason we did is because it's a hard case, right? So it's a very much political and economically salient field, but also it's a very much hard case. Let me actually kind of decompose this and outline why this is the case. First of all, it's politically salient because we know that in both countries, the issue of pension reform actually was quite controversial for the society, but especially for the special interest groups, for unions, for social actors. So in that sense, we know it's politically salient at the time. Also in economic terms, we actually know that this kind of reforms, this policy area actually had great economic significance for both governments. First of all, they were spending less than the Eurozone average before the reforms. And then we actually see in both of them a significant rise of the spending on social policy, on pension spending. So in that sense, we know it's an economic salient topic.
They were spending less in terms of total expenditure, but Greece was spending more on pension.
Indeed. And last but not least, I mean, we kind of pick the one topic that the literature has actually, I mean, Kevin and Platon Tinius has written quite extensively on that, the one case that the literature actually has shown that it's very difficult to reform. So the pension policy literature actually has been shown that it's one of the most difficult cases to actually have any kind of meaningful reform, especially because of the fragmentation of the system and the union opposition at the time. So, in a sense, we actually pick one of the most difficult cases we could find in the literature to see whether we can actually unpack the dynamics there and whether some reform, any kind of reform, really happened because of the use of the fiscal space.
Yes, I mean, just some graphs very roughly. As I said before, for both countries, there is a decline in the interest rates. We have increasing tax revenues coming from the growing economy, and of course the interest payment as a percentage of GDP goes down. Just showing a bit what we were discussing before about the room for fiscal maneuver. Before going into the cases, we wanted to summarize the argument here, and we wanted to say that what we claim is that amplified market forces that came with the euro increased the room for national and fiscal maneuver, which allowed governments to implement reforms that reduced poverty and inequality among the elderly in both economies. Yet, because we know that we are going to receive this question later, we want to make clear that these domestic political choices around welfare policies remain path dependent. So we'll come back to that in the conclusion, just to make sure that we have that in our mind. We won't say that everything changed, but we want to give a more nuanced picture of what actually happened.
So now we're actually going to the nuts and bolts of the paper, so the case studies and what we looked actually to establish our argument. I'm going to start with Greece. I mean, in general, for those of you who are interested, we actually did some thematic analysis of Greek literature sources, so, you know, official documents, the legal documents. Then we actually look at primary and secondary sources, and then some media analysis. And this is the data we came up with, essentially. So let me start with Greece. For Greece, actually, before entering the Eurozone, the pension reform was a quite salient topic. It was the one policy field where the Commission was asking the Greek government to really reform because it was quite costly. So it was one of the reforms that actually was seen as very important in order to achieve the Eurozone accession goal. In that sense, the government really actually picked up this target and actually proposed a reform that had two main goals, right? The first one was the attenuation of the generous benefits that the privileged groups, the insiders that I talked about before, had at the time. And the second one was actually the improvement of the minimum social benefits for the outsiders. It's important here to note that these kind of two goals were actually tied with the modernization rhetoric of it. As Christa said before, the modernization rhetoric here did not have to do with structural reforms and fiscal discipline, but it actually had to do more with essentially ensuring the fiscal sustainability of the system while at the same time making sure that some kind of equality and social justice was achieved. As the main inspirator of the whole idea in Greece said at the time, the then Prime Minister Tsimitis, the dilemma between fiscal sustainability of the pension system and social justice is a false dilemma. As soon as the reform was actually realized in an efficient manner, the dilemma would be said, and both goals would be essentially achieved. So let me start on how these actually reforms unfolded in the Greek case. The first important one that we had was the ECAS reform back in 1996. It was a mean tested cash benefit for the pensioners that were actually really at the risk of poverty. The ECAS reform was actually fairly successful, especially in its early years, and it actually did not stir much controversy because it was actually funded by the state budget and did not involve any kind of redirection of funds from the existing pensioners. So the government, seeing that actually this whole idea works, moved forward to kind of implement a wider reform of the pension system. So in 1997, the next year, it actually brings together a committee of experts, the Sprouse Committee, which actually publishes the Sprouse Report. The Sprouse Report actually did try to move the pension system towards a more equitable but also more fiscal sustainable direction. So it actually suggested the prolongation of working life, but more importantly, it suggested the unification of pension funds and the redirection of funds from the most privileged pension funds to the ones that actually were mainly representing the outsiders of the system. And also kind of suggested the reversal of the funding flow within the pension system. So the insiders at that point would actually fund the pension funds of the outsiders. As you might imagine, this kind of proposal provoked quite a lot of fierce opposition by the unions and political parties at the time. Important caveat here, the main unions in Greece were actually representative of the insiders of the pension system. So in that sense, they didn't actually see the unification of the pension funds, the direction of funds, with a very much positive eye. So you had a lot of strikes, and the government, seeing the elections 2 years down the line, kind of withdrew from the reform. After winning the election in 2000, it came back with a new reform plan, a new bill in 2001, which kind of toned down and watered down the Sprouse report suggestions, but again kind of suggested the unification of funds and up to a point the direction of funds from the insiders to the outside. Once again, you had the union opposition, quite effective strikes, and the government quickly again withdraws from the deal and kind of begins with this 6 months consultation with social partners where the unions actually had quite a central role to play. The final law that came up at the time was more or less mirroring a compromise between the insiders, the unions, and the government. From the one hand, the unions managed to actually get even more state funding in terms of their social pensions, but also the public employees managed to secure some kind of early retirement benefits being within the typology of hard and arduous professions, which actually gave them quite generous pension package. On the other hand, what the government managed to do is actually get some reforms like limiting the minimum pension at 70% for future retirees, but also to actually establish certain measures that would secure that even the pensioners that were right at the line of poverty would have some kind of basic income. So in that sense, we see a compromise that the government managed to do at the time, where you actually buy off the potential users of the reform, i.e. the insiders of the system, while you actually manage to implement some reforms towards a more equitable base. So in that sense, you did have a compromise. Yet again, the obvious downside of this kind of compromise is that the fiscal sustainability of the system is not secured, right? It's premised on the notion that you do have actually this kind of fiscal space. That was the Greek case. Let me move quite quickly to the Irish case. So Ireland has been actually criticized quite extensively for not providing any kind of welfare benefits. The discussion about what they can do with regard to the pensioners that were close to the poverty line in Ireland already started from 1996, from what was called the Rainbow Coalition, a grand coalition of Conservatives, Labour, and Greens, and it moved forward by the new government that came in place in 1997, which was more like towards the centre right, the liberal government. All these reforms and the discussion was actually done in coordination, in conjunction with the Pension Bureau at the time, which was kind of this this independent committee of experts or social partners who actually gave input, expert input, before any reform. And this has actually a quite central place, a role, with regard to the reform effort. The overall goal of the government, but also of the reports at the time, was to actually ensure the adequate provision of pension for all parts of the population. Ireland had a problem that quite significant parts of the population, especially female employees, were not actually covered by their insurance system. So in that sense, that was the overall theme. I have to say here that this kind of goal was supported by had quite wide support. It actually enjoyed a consensus. So there was this idea that as long as Ireland actually has this economic boom, it's experienced an economic boom, and it had young employees who are very productive, it had to deal with this kind of pension reform. So the first report that came out in 1998 had, as I said, this kind of idea that more sections of the population had to actually somehow be covered by the pension reform. And indeed, the government bill that was actually adopted in 2001 did establish the personal retirement savings account, which was kind of aiming to establish that everyone in Ireland, every employee, would have some kind of pension at the end of his working life. It also increased the state pensions by 3.7%. It's very important to note here that this bill was actually adopted without much opposition. Why is that? Because Ireland has this model in place, the social partnership model, which actually makes sure that the government is working very close with social partners and the unions, and essentially the bill at the time would actually enjoy the union support. Moreover, the expert body that was established prior to the reform, the Pension Bureau, kind of had a very much inclusive structure, including union and social partners. So in that sense, the expert team that the government received was actually very much in line with the preferences of the main potential opposition groups. The second reform was actually premised on a review that was done again by the Pension Board in 2015, which again actually evaluated the progress of the previous bill. It found that it was lagging behind, especially with cattle with female employees, so they were not covered by the pension system, and it kind of asked the government to step up its effort toward that direction. And indeed, the new government bill in 2007 really, really, really focused on covering more female employees and making sure that they actually receive some kind of pension at the end of their working life. I mean, number two, beneficial measures for the spouse of contributory pensions is very much indicative. Here I have to actually put a caveat in all this and say that the Irish pension system was premised on a two-pillar system, right? So the one was actually state-funded, it made sure that you had like some basic provision in terms of pension provision, and the second part was actually based on some kind of complementarity, where you actually had private pension schemes that the employees used to kind of complement their funds. In order to attract more people to this kind of private pension schemes, the government did provide some tax reliefs at the time, which ended up actually benefiting the top quantiles of the income distribution, right? So on the one hand, the reform did benefit the poor, the ones actually that were not covered by the system, by actually establishing some kind of basic pension for them. But on the other hand, it was very much beneficial for the potential users of the system, right? For the top income quantiles, who actually got some quite quite rich and generous tax breaks in order to, you know, to join this kind of private pension scheme.
Okay. Thanks, Angela. So the idea of what Agios has been suggesting is that we have two very different country cases with very different veto players and with different reform efforts. And in both of the cases, we managed to see parametric reforms that are actually aiming towards a more equitable system, towards the outsiders of the system. Increasing public pensions in the case of Ireland, and at the same time, also in the case of Greece with the implementation of ECAS. What does this imply? I mean, we see that something that we didn't mention before, or we did mention it and I'm forgetting it, it is always discussed that Greece had a problem of fiscal sustainability with its pension system, but it had also another very severe problem, which was the risk of poverty and inequality among pensioners. So Ireland and Greece both were ranking very badly compared to the euro area average in terms of inequality and in terms of poverty among the elderly. So the idea, as we said before, is that the systems, both of these two systems, were having the same problem. So what happens after the common currency? So inequality over the age of 65 measured as 80 is 30 goes down, both in the case of Greece, makes stable during the master period, but then goes a bit down. It goes down also in the case of Finland. And after 2000, poverty is also reduced. At risk of poverty among pensioners is reduced in both of the cases. Just give me one second. So what we are suggesting here is that in both of the cases, the creation of fiscal space that came with the euro allowed governments to implement reforms, which were not, as we said, radical, did not deal with the issue of fiscal sustainability, but did reduce poverty and inequality among the elderly. What does this tell us? So why are we interested in all this thing if still these reforms were quite minor? Well, we say that there are good reasons that we actually went into the details of our TK studies, because we consider, first of all, that we try to contribute to the literature of the euro area adoption of inequality. And while up to now it was always linked with this, you know, hard budget constraints, we are saying, well, there may be another link, which is the loose budget constraints and the creation of fiscal space during the first years of the euro, a concept which remains relevant after the crisis as well, and we can discuss it. So there was some room for fiscal maneuver for national governments, and they did use it up to an extent also for equality-enhancing reforms. So, secondly, we consider that we contribute to the literature of reforms because mainly Villaverde et al. Are linking loose budget constraints to institutional deterioration. And we say, well, okay, we know the debate of efficiency, we know about the issue of fiscal sustainability, let's look a bit at what happened in terms of equality back in the days. Well, are these policies still path-dependent? As I said, I promised to return back to that. Of course they are path-dependent. Greece continued to have a pension bias in its welfare state. Social spending increased also in other transfers, but still the rest of the transfer remained below 2% of GDP. So most of its spending again went to pensions. But we see at least for the first time that it was done in a way to include outsiders of the system, something that they couldn't do before exactly due to the fact that you had all these veto players blocking every reform effort. Now they had the space and they did it. Respective governments did it, both PASOK government, but I mean we can discuss about the politics of the thing, but also a new democracy government. Then we suggest also that in the case of Ireland, of course, there were path-dependent choices. We know how much in Ireland we discuss about tax reliefs. They did it once again by benefiting the upper part of their distribution, but at the same time, they also were quite inclusive in their pension reforms. So we hope that by going into the details of these so well-discussed reforms, that we hope to change a bit the narratives. Not everything that happened during that decade was, you know, catastrophic. There have been some reform efforts that were quite serious, even in terms of fiscal sustainability, and quite effective in terms of being more equitable. Were the problems solved? No, of course. I mean, still, in the case of Greece, you have pensioners spending as a percentage of GDP below the EA average. At the same time, you may have the problem of the shift of poverty towards the working population, because if you continue spending on the elderly ones, that would probably mean that you have no resources left for the others. But during that decade, it made sense because the economy was growing. So you had to deal with the most vulnerable part of your population, which were the pensioners. So this is the idea. We're very happy you're here, and we hope to discuss it further. Thank you for coming.
Okay, thank you both very much. We've got plenty of time for questions and comments. Could I please ask you to introduce yourselves when you ask your question or make a very brief comment. And may I remind you that this conversation is being taped for a future podcast, so anything you say will be used against you in the future, so please keep it safe. Vasilis.
So we can claim different names.
Yeah, but we know who you are.
So Vasilis Masgiotis here from the Hellenic Observatory. I'm not sure I understand exactly the argument, because you seem to say that when the fiscal space was created, then the redistribution started, because otherwise how could the fiscal space cause the redistribution? But you showed us that both in Ireland and in Greece, the objective of redistribution started earlier, in the 90s, in the bad years of no fiscal space. And okay, in Ireland it continued until 2007,
yeah.
But in Greece, from what I understood, you stopped looking at pension reforms in 2001.
No.
Where there was, okay, but in the PowerPoint,
yes,
it was,
yes,
2001.
Yes.
Where there was no, I mean, you know, you cannot claim the fiscal space was created within days after Greece.
No, it starts already from the reduction of the, from, with the convergence,
yeah,
of interest rates. So let's say back in the 1995 when the interest rates started falling. So it happens before the adoption. Because you have the interest rates all starting already falling from mid-90s, right?
Okay.
So this is a euro effect.
And then you do show that poverty among the elderly declined.
Mm-hmm.
You don't show whether it declined faster than among other groups of the population. So maybe declined everywhere, poverty. And then the inequality that you show is inequality among pensioners. But again, we don't know what happened to inequality poverty. So basically what I'm saying is that, you know, you can select all the left-handed people and say inequality among left-handed people fell.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you look at the right-handed people, maybe it also fell. So being left-handed doesn't affect anything if it happened to both groups. So then I don't know whether the distributive effort of the 90s explains what happened in 2005, 6, 7 in terms of inequality and poverty outcomes, not knowing what happened to the rest of the population. And whether the fiscal space, I mean, Greece was consolidating very fast, I don't know about Ireland, but in the 90s, late 90s, Greece was consolidating fast because they wanted to meet the target. So to say that in 97, Simitis thought, oh, we have fiscal space, is a bit of a puzzle to me. To say that the non-central left government of 2004-05 felt they had fiscal space, but when
they both did.
Okay, but in the 90s, I don't think that anybody felt they had fiscal space. So
do we reply or do we?
Yes, no, please, because there are a couple of hands up.
So first of all, as I said, I mean, it starts with the convergence of the interest rates. It starts already before the actual adoption of the common currency. The two countries adopting different times. Greece adopts in 2001, and Ireland 1999. And we see that in Ireland there is some effort to meet the Maastricht criteria, but then there is an increase in social spending after the adoption of the common currency. Also, the 2 years that Greece was trying to adjust, again, there was some, there was no increase in social spending, but afterward, again, it increases. So in that sense, I believe that the effect starts earlier. So what you say that they wouldn't feel it, I don't agree with you. So I believe that they could actually feel it quite substantially without falling interest rates. So your question of whether, what does inequality do among the other bits of the population? So inequality remains, goes a bit down in Greece, it remains also, it goes down, but we see a more important increase in the case of pensioners, that we have more of an increase in spending. We don't want to make general claims of inequality on that paper, that's why we focused on particular area of transfers. So our main idea was to see whether in these reform efforts there were these considerations in mind. And actually, because with Angelos, we looked at the reforms before the convergence of interest rates, also reform efforts that happened back in the 90s, both for Ireland and for Greece. While there was this rhetoric of we need to make that more equitable, they didn't. So actually, it seems for us that the timing of the fact that this is happening is due to the fact that for the first time they can avoid a war of attrition. So they do have the room to actually give also to the outsiders of the system. So, I mean.
So, but in 93, this had a deficit of like 4-5%, so they had a lot of space. And in 2001, they had a deficit of 3%, so they had no space.
So, you mean.
They were overspending before then, yeah.
They were overspending before 1990. So then, I mean. I would suggest, and the economy was growing at the same pace as it was going in 2000, because one of the things is that you could have also a lot of increasing tax revenues into Europe, you had capital inflows into the economy, and also you were not endangering your market access at all. You didn't try to enter, you were already there, and the economy was booming. So in that sense, yes, you did have the room, more room, to actually be able to implement this sort of reforms. I don't know, Michael, if you want
to. There's also this paper from Paulatos and I don't remember the other name, where they actually show that as Greece were actually getting closer to the Euro accession, the conditionality of the accession was actually becoming more lenient, and you know, it actually breaks off entirely when they enter the Euro. So I mean, you could make the argument that you don't have any space. I mean, no, you have some space as you're getting closer to actually entering the Euro, and it's a good paper actually. It's not well cited there, but they do show that.
Angelo
Martelli, European Institute. Just following up on what Vasilis was saying, I think it's important to show what has happened also to the other, what happens to the other age cohorts, because it proves the point.
The other
age cohorts, whether basically inequality has been transferred to them. So intergenerational equity is at the core. Because then it also proves your point whether we have moved away from clientelism or not. Because I don't fully buy the argument that you know, we have actually not cared just of the insiders, but we are actually extending this distribution to outsiders. Because in a way, in a country like Italy, and I don't know about Greece, but pensioners are embedded very much into the system, and trade unions just care about pensioners, and I think they are the insiders. So I don't think that, I don't fully buy that, you know, there is less inequality in a way if you don't show that this is not the case with the other age cohorts.
That inequality also declines for them as well.
Yeah.
I do have that graph, but I don't have it here. It does. If this is your question, so inequality goes down for them.
Yeah, but it depends on the range.
Yeah, exactly.
It goes down.
But I think that you misunderstood something. We don't make a claim that the clientelistic welfare state of Greece is over. So we actually saw very well in our paper that every reform effort that Greek governments tried to do was blocked by vested interests. This is something which is also very interesting to see, that there was a lot of reform effort during that decade, despite the fact that we always tend to say nothing happened. No, there was serious reform effort, always blocked. So we don't claim that now we are in a magnificent system that everyone is doing. We are just saying that compared to previous reforms, we see this time that the issue of enhancing equality is more public in the rhetoric of the governments, and at the same time that it seems that it is also done. So we had annual increases from 2000 in pension spending that are always progressive. So always the lowest part of the pensioners were getting more, especially between 2000 and 2004. So it's something that it seems that it is happening.
I know, but if this comes at the cost, a huge cost for younger cohorts.
So you mean if the system remains skewed only towards that? So in the case of Ireland, let me clarify that. So in the case of Ireland, you have, with the Euro, despite the fact that our paper is not dealing with that, you have social spending increasing in all transfers, and especially family benefits. So the most substantial increase is in pension spending, but also family benefits seem to increase massively. In the case of Greece, yes, there is a continuation, as I said before, of pension bias, as it was before, but for the first time in a more equitable manner. I don't know if I answered your question. But in the case of Ireland, it is not only pensions that are increasing, but also there are other transfers that seem to increase a lot after the introduction of the common currency.
Thank you very much for the paper. I really enjoyed it. I know it from a young age, so I think it's a very valuable contribution. Like, it's a very ambitious paper, first of all, and it's a valuable contribution to changing, I don't know, the narrative of what happened in this first years of the Euro. Yeah, which we can, which it is easy to forget in like the Euro crisis, and I think that's very interesting. What I wanted to ask you is the following. I buy the argument that basically fiscal space is a necessary condition for this kind of more equalizing version of reform slash modernization to happen. I'm just wondering, can you describe in some more abstract way, like whether there is a second condition that is also necessary, namely some type of politics, right? Some type of government vision. Because I would imagine that it's not necessary just because there's fiscal space, any government that comes will provide more equalizing function? Like, what are the characteristics that, in a sense, unify those most different cases and produce this result? Yeah.
You want to try?
No.
You go for it. Why not?
You go for it.
Come on, somebody.
Yes.
First of all, super interesting question, right? Yes, it's only, I mean, that's at the beginning, that was our thought, that it's only necessary but not sufficient. And what makes it sufficient? Well, I would be very keen in saying that we wanted to see whether politics matter. That's why we chose two different country cases, right? So we chose the case of Ireland with a more liberal coalition government and the case of Greece. Do politics matter? We found that not that much. They do slightly. So in the sense that always in the case of Ireland, it was all about poverty reduction. Poverty reduction among persons, poverty reduction among persons. In a more center-left government, it was also an issue of inequality. So the rhetoric was a bit different between the two governments. But at the same time, we see that across the political spectrum, these reforms were implemented. One idea would be that whether this issue is salient or not. So you have, indeed, as Angelo said before, pensions are quite salient issues. It's an increasing part of the electorate. Up to an extent, that makes it highly ranked in the political agendas, right? So in that sense, should it be that it is a sufficient condition, the necessary condition of the fiscal space, and the issue to be very electorally important, so for the governments to act? I don't know if Angelos has any other ideas on that.
It's difficult to establish with this comparison the directionality of the reform. You have the problem that you actually have an across case comparison between two countries, so you have Greece and Ireland here. So while you have actually governments of different political orientations, so you put in the variable of ideology or whatever, you know, prime ministers or you name it, you have the very different political systems, right? So, I mean, you do have in Ireland the social partnership framework, which actually makes it a quite bizarre case. And then you have Greece, which is a quite polarized political system at the time. So it's difficult to actually establish ideology. What would be a good idea is actually make an over the time comparison in Greece between the Tsimikas government of the center left and the center-right government of Karamanlis that follows. And we have actually, there is a line about this on the paper, saying that the Karamanlis government more or less continued this objective, but you had an increase, I think, in all areas of social standing. That's what we found, if I remember correctly, right?
No, in all parts of the distribution of the pensioners to the same extent. So it seemed that it was more in the Tsimikas agenda.
So it was more in the Tsimikas agenda. So yeah, I mean, up to a point it plays a role in Greece, but I mean, do you see a significant difference? Do you see actually some kind of more aggressive approach? Because, I mean, if we're interested in the directionality of the reform, you should actually answer if it's progressive or regressive. Do we see a major shift? No, not really. But again, can we actually extrapolate on this and say politics matter or do not matter? It comes from Greece, which is a very, you know, a very status case in a way. I mean, even the set right in Greece for some time was quite status force.
But would you agree that it depends on the saliency of the issue? So would you say that?
Certainly. But again, I mean, saliency, what does that even mean? I mean, it's a huge fiscal index, right? I mean, it is salient pretty much all around the Western world, right? So, I mean, pensions are important.
It happens also outside the Eurozone at the time. It's not only that, but our argument is that it enabled for this laggards of social policy provision, because both Greece and Ireland were countries that actually social spending was lagging behind. And what we mainly claim is that it allowed them to do probably what was happening also in other parts of the world.
I mean, you have from the European Institute. You have a classical problem of at the moment how you make the case, and I find it also convincing, and as Kira said, this story also has to be told a bit. But concluding from policy outcomes to policies, right? Declining inequality, and that's due to a pension reform. So much else can have happened. Mm-hmm. Do you have any direct evidence that, say, the imminent entry into the euro area played a role in these pension reforms, either as, oh, we have to because of the fiscal rules, or we can, and it becomes easier if we now phase that in because we get this room through lower public debt service?
I think you do have it for sure in Ireland, where the debate is actually very much around the euro and what actually does it mean to be part of the euro. And there is this sense that, you know, the adoption of the euro and the robust growth of Ireland, so the two are actually in conjunction at the time, actually are a perfect opportunity, kind of a window of opportunity to deal with the system at the time. So you do have this actually at the parliamentary debates at the time, but also in the press. So very much evident there in an explicit manner.
In Greece
up to a point, but I would say there it's more conflated, right? Because you have the government playing the two-level game. It's not quite clear what the euro would mean at the time. So, I mean, I would need to go back and look again at the data there, because
I don't agree with the Greek case, because I believe that it gives the opportunity. That's the thing. I mean, if you read the Semitic speeches of the time, it gives the opportunity for a change in the rhetoric. So the fact that the Eurozone is pushing for a reform in terms of fiscal sustainability of the pension system, because this was the big issue of the time. Either you manage to do that and you prove that you are a country that can reform, or if you don't do that, then you are, you know, the ones that never manage. So this gives an opportunity at the time to include in the discussion the issue of equality of the pension system. So while the original idea from the Commission is, okay, what will we do with the pension spending that it is, you know, so substantial, all the rhetoric of Semitic includes also the problem of fragmentation. So I don't know if it is the euro that allows it, or that it allows for a platform that this thing is discussed more openly. Whether he uses the idea of fiscal space to say, well, we do have more space now. No, on that I agree with Agnes. In Ireland it's more clearly said that, okay, it's a good time to do that.
But
that's a good point of managing to overcome the first two points, so not from policy outcomes, but actually to show that whether we can find it more explicitly. Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's it, so this point.
What you're saying is that it's not that whether Semitis thought about fiscal space, we don't know. It is that he clearly didn't think about fiscal space. He implemented a reform day one when he got in, which was redistributive, before he realized, you know, in 1996. Yeah, well before there was all this realized fiscal space, while they were doing fiscal consolidation, and then in 97 and 2001, he tried to do a fiscal consolidation reform exactly to try to make the system sustainable, and he failed. Okay, so to say that he was aware of the fiscal space, and then he thought, I'm center left, I will redistribute. He was trying to cut the pension expenditure.
But always with Angelos is more on the Greek case, but all of the reforms entailed parametric elements that were towards. So we focused on the ECAS because it was the most clear-cut case.
Well, right? ECAS before fiscal space.
Yes, and it is implemented during this year, so the resources for ECAS are coming for fiscal space. So we may start discussing the ECAS reform 1996. But it happens during the period that you actually do have the resources to do it.
But also, Vasily, even if we take your point and say it's all about fiscal austerity and it's all about meeting the criteria and hitting the targets.
I take the point that the Pasok government wanted to redistribute to poor pensioners. I mean,
but you don't get the point that they managed to do because they had room for maneuver coming from the euro. So which part of the point you don't?
The latter, yes. Because they started before they had the room.
The mid-90s,
increasing
fiscal space.
Yes, because this is where the convergence starts.
But may also say something. The ECAS reform is a far smaller reform than the one that is actually implemented at the very end. So in 2001, you have a full-fledged reform of the system. The ECAS reform is a mean test benefit for certain parts of the system. It's very focused, right? I mean, so we're not saying the government didn't have the preference at the time. What gave the PASOK government the ability to actually maneuver and kind of implement this bigger reform, this full-fledged reform? You know, obviously, in terms of fiscal stability, it wasn't very successful, but, you know, actually including outsiders more inside the scheme actually was the fiscal space.
But, Vasilis, if you had evidence that in 1995 already we had fiscal space, right? Because this is what I claim, that it doesn't happen only with the introduction, it happens before in the period of convergence. Would you be more convinced? So that... Because in 1996, interest rates already fell. So it's not that you enter in 2001 and then you have interest rate convergence. You start having a process of going into the Eurozone, which means that already you have a reduction of the cost of your public debt. The economy is quite of growing. I mean, of course, you didn't meet, and we all know that...
They ran the elections with a manifesto for fiscal consolidation. So if they were aware they had fiscal space, and they ran the elections saying we're going to cut expenditure...
It's asking a bit much to say they have to know that there's fiscal space, a term of art that has become recently so fashionable. If you could show that they said, look, we can get with the engineer, we build a modern pension system that becomes viable and sustainable, and at the same time we can do the right thing and reduce our poverty, then I would say that is conclusive evidence that they also saw this as a policy opportunity. And that would be direct evidence. But that has to be seen.
Okay, while Vasilis thinks about that, let me move on and we'll come back to the discussion in a second. Stella.
Saying is that there was fiscal space there earlier on than we actually imagined. So you have to spend more time, haven't read the paper, maybe you're already doing it, spend time explaining why you say that, because this is the novel thing about the paper, this fiscal space existing much earlier than we actually thought, and then maybe compare what you're finding show that what you're saying about the pensioners is really about not the pensioners that were insiders, but the pensioners that they were the outsiders. So more evidence that when you say that there's more inequality, it really referred to the pensioners that before wouldn't get access, not only to the ones that were insiders, but that I think was a very valid point. Mm-hmm. And then maybe compare with another group, since you have the data. So get rid of some of the description of what is happening in the countries, because you don't really need it. The novel thing is what you're saying about the Eurozone.
She took more with Chris.
There's obviously been some kind of internal discussion about this before.
Well,
it was even more descriptive.
No, I. So the general idea behind it is, of course, that what we try to do in this paper is to link the debate of loose budget constraints with inequalities, what I was saying in the beginning. So it's not that we have this novel idea that Europe provides soft budget constraints. This has already been discussed. What has not been discussed is how is this linked with inequality and social spending, and what did this mean probably in terms of making fragmented systems more equitable. So we do buy that point, but this is how we started the whole thing. But then we have to find a way of convincing people that this was the case, and that's why we said, all right, how can we actually do that? Let's take pensions. Everyone says that it's, extremely difficult to reform, that we wouldn't expect that we would see anything, computer vested interest, and let's try to show that. Maybe you're right that we went a bit into the detail and we should have...
What you're saying here, we're not interested in the process and how difficult it was. We're interested in the outputs. So you can show in various different groups that used to be excluded, that they're becoming included. We don't care if it was difficult or not for this particular argument. So why to discuss the process?
I think you're right.
Show us the policy outputs and compare them in different categories, and then it becomes much stronger.
I think that's a very good point, and I think that we can do already. I mean, I was reading reports from the Bank of Greece at the time. Maybe I can send something like that to Vasilis to be convinced, that was actually saying that it was the outsiders of the system that have been very much benefiting. So your idea is instead of going to every typical paper that is like every paper that discusses, okay, how did the pension reform play out, we say, well, we know it was hard, but let's see who benefited from that, and that makes the link stronger with our argument, so then it's not lost so much into the details.
Problem solved.
Very good.
And presented in the wrong.
Good, thank you.
Spiros, no questions from you?
Yeah, I've got a question. It's something you mentioned. I'm completely ignorant about all of these things, obviously, because You know, I don't understand. I don't do numbers and I don't do political economy.
Neither do us. I don't know why.
Well, but there was something that interested me that I wasn't sure exactly what you meant. You mentioned on two different occasions path dependencies.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't too sure exactly what you were referring to. What are the political choices that have unintended consequences? What is the path dependencies being set by whom and in what context? And I wasn't exactly too sure how that works, because there was a discussion a bit about political choices and ideology,
mm-hmm.
and you sort of said, well, that's not really entirely relevant, but then you talked about path dependencies. Could you say a bit more about that?
Mm-hmm. So mainly what I meant by that, but I don't know if it was clear, it was that, maybe it is due to the fear of the first time that this paper was presented, and you know, they were telling us, yes, but still, you know, pension bias continued. Yes, still, but Ireland made an effort to reduce poverty, but it did remain along the lines of, you know, also reducing taxation. So they tried, so the first time we presented that was they were telling us, look, there were some changes, but these changes were not, I mean, up to the next session, you know, that they will completely shift the welfare state system as we know it. So in that sense, maybe I was underlying that so much because I was trying to say that we are aware that still some of the characteristics of the welfare state continue to be there without a change. So as I said to Angelo before, no, we don't expect that vested interest would vanish and then suddenly we would have a very inclusive system. No, but at the same time, we've seen some effort. This is what I meant by saying that there were some sort of path dependencies there in the welfare provision.
The argument is based on recognizing and analyzing incremental reforms, no reform that actually changed the overall face of the system in other countries. So
I don't know if this answers your question.
Yeah, maybe that's something you need to emphasize, though, because you just introduced as an idea of this path dependencies here, and then it's never really brought up in the same way. Maybe something you need to emphasize in the paper to show that incremental reform that is on a particular path and is dependent on certain other things. The other point I was going to raise, I think, is probably related somehow to what Stella pointed out to. Okay, your case studies may be interesting, but what I want to hear, well, no, they may be in their own right, and there may be a paper there which does this comparison and does it in a very good way. But what I was more interested in terms of what you were saying is, what is generalizable about this? And this comes back to the question I think that Stella was asking for. What do we learn from this that can be applied more broadly? What do we learn from this that is relevant to a wider group of scholars, a wider group of cases, a wider group of people, and that would allow us to make more of this argument, which among the experts here has some traction. People say this is interesting, this is valuable, this is new, this contributes. But does it contribute to somebody who's interested only in a specific group of states? Does it make it valuable for somebody who does pension reform or does fiscal space and fiscal headroom? I'd like to know how this is generalizable, if it is at all, to a broader audience of experts.
You're not going to like my answer.
I'm not going to like your answer.
Well, I like your answer.
Try me.
The paper is based on this kind of looking at the literature that actually looks at the technology of reforms in emerging economies, right? So actually we start from this premise of war of attrition and reform postponement. And we kind of take these concepts and we apply them in two cases in the Eurozone. We feel it contributes a lot on the Eurozone debate. We feel it contributes a lot on our understanding of how the Eurozone dynamic actually played out in domestic politics for quite some time. It fits in within the debate of how you actually implement difficult reforms and maybe long-term reforms, because reforms with long-term consequences in developed and Western economies. But I would say the contribution there is incremental again. I feel it offers a different understanding and narrative about the beginning of the Eurozone, which is important for a EU studies scholar. I wouldn't say we make an important contribution of people who are looking at reform trajectories and technologies in emerging economies.
I do not agree with my... And I would say that, the debate of fiscal space is more prominent than ever. I mean, we were in a presentation today that it was discussed, and especially after the crisis, there is this discussion of how much fiscal space do actually countries have, and whether there is some room for maneuver. And I would say that in general, I mean, extending it even beyond our two country cases to other Eurozone states to contribute to the Eurozone inequality debate is relevant. But even think also of this two-level thing of the creation of fiscal space and then what do actually governments have to can do with that. So we know we live in an era that we say, well, governments have tight hands, the Eurozone was a golden straitjacket, we live in the era of austerity, governments seem to have nothing at their hands now, but my idea would be, well, maybe we can link it to broader debates of political economy and go there and see, okay, how could this be used? And what do we do with this, you know, fiscal space? Does this mean that actually we still have some room for, you know, redistribution policies? I know I sound a bit dramatic here, but I would say that I would link it also to broader things.
Is it not the, to me, the paper is explaining a very big puzzle that those created always say, oh, getting into the euro was all about restricting yourself, going on a path that you never signed up to, your political economy or something. How is this democratically possible? If you just say we have now less policy space for anything, I find that utterly impossible to explain in after all, mature democracies or new democracies. You must have given credibly the impression we can achieve things that we couldn't do without it. And this could be, yes, a limited, but some evidence.
Definitely, and I mean, some scholars have already pointed that out. So they say you have to be quite crazy to go only to, you know, a union that's only vehicle external and structural reforms, and there is no room for redistributive politics. But I think that it has already been slightly recognized that, look, I mean, this fall of interest rates, I mean, Iverson, I just have benefits for these economies that go beyond. I mean, just simply, you know, the elimination of exchange rates, the population seem to have served some of these benefits, and this is not so well discussed in the literature. So I think we can definitely, discuss that further. I mean, I think we did, not today, but many times we gave this battle of trying to say that it did make sense. There were good reasons for entering. Yeah?
But there's two things here. One is whether the population, the benefit from the fiscal space, and whether they benefited equitably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a second step that, you know, you need to explain why they did the equitably, because they could, as you said in the introduction, they could have used the proceeds to pay off the insiders, mm-hmm. the friends, and whatever.
Yeah, that's.
I'm just saying.
No, that's a very good point. So, I understand. So, even if there is a fiscal space, why was it used in a way that it would lift? Probably everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which could relate to what Walter was saying about the legitimization of the process and how it evolved.
Yeah.
I was going to say something else, but since you said that, well, maybe you don't need to do that in this paper, because if you just saw that it happened equitably, it's already novel. And the why can come in the next paper, you know? Because really, I mean, I'm not saying to multiply the papers.
That's fine.
Already an argument that has not been made enough in the Eurozone literature. And actually, I think ideally you're very modest to say that it cannot go fly even further. Because if you think of all the IMF programs, as you very well know, even in developing countries, there's always this debate of, you know, constraint versus redistribution.
Yes.
So if you're showing that in the Eurozone this could happen, it could happen in other occasions. So this could, you know,
research agenda.
You come in with one and get up with two.
That's
the
observatory
target today.
Any more questions or comments? No? Okay, well, we are very early today, but since nobody else wants to chip in, we'll draw proceedings to a close. Before thanking you, could I just make a very quick announcement about upcoming seminars? In a week's time, on Wednesday, the 20th of November, we have a topic not very distant from what you've been discussing today, a topic of will Greece reform? The speaker is Nikos Kostandaris, who's a columnist for Kathmandu newspaper, and that's going to be on Wednesday, the 20th of November at 18:30 here in the Centre Building, just across the way. And following that, on Wednesday the 27th of November, we have a panel discussion on the theme of brain gain, an exciting future for Greece. The panelists are Angeliki Kosmopoulou, who's executive director of the AC Laskaridis Foundation, Konstantinos Kiranakis, who's a member of parliament, and Angela Stathi, who's the chief executive officer of Reload Greece. So that's on Wednesday the 27th of November at, again, 18:30. Before I let you go, please join me in thanking Sula and Angelos for their paper, and we wish them the best of luck in this paper and the other 18 they have to write.